And Radio Dub is on the air. Welcome once again, listeners, from your statically genial host, John Derbyshire, here to bring you VDare.com's weekly summary of the news, garnished with some sceptical commentary. This week's podcast begins with three bulletin items. Items, I mean, about the podcast itself. First bulletin item, this coming Monday, May 27th, marks Radio Derb's 15th birthday. Our first podcast went out on May 27th, 2004. I don't know if that makes Radio Derb the oldest podcast continuously on the airwaves, or cyberwaves, whatever they're called. But I'll bet we are the longest-running podcast with a dissident right flavour. I'll allow that the flavour was somewhat muted in the early years when Radio Derb was hosted by National Review, but I don't recall fudging my commentary on that account. If I thought some topic would bring the censor's axe down on me, I just left it alone. I was often wrong in my predictions. You're doing pretty well in the commentary business if you're batting 500. But I was never dishonest. If you want to check those statements for yourself, every single podcast of these last 15 years, 689 of them, has its transcript archived on my personal website, johndarbyshire.com. All but one of them include the original sound file. I don't know why that one sound file went missing. Go to johndarbyshire.com, click on Opinions in the box at the right, and then on Radio Derb on the Opinions page. A word of caution about those transcripts. I've been toiling away to get them under a standard format, breaking up too long paragraphs, recovering dead hyperlinks and so on. Also, purging out Adobe Flash, which I used for audio delivery until recently. Adobe will stop supporting Flash next year. This is slow work, though, and so far I'm only up to November 2009. I estimate I'll be finished with it around the middle of next year. That's my first bulletin item. Happy birthday, Radio Derb. You are now a 15-year-old adolescent, self-conscious and ornery. Second bulletin item. In celebration of Radio Derb's 15th, I shall be taking a week off. My lady and I shall, in fact, be taking a road trip up to the frozen tundra of Ontario and Quebec to visit friends and see sights, leaving the homestead in the capable hands of Derb Jr. So, once again, no Radio Derb on May 31st. Our next podcast will be on June 7th, when I myself will be 1 year older. Should 1 week without hearing my mellifluous tones be too much for you to bear, you can, of course, go to johndarbyshire.com and listen to Radio Derbs from the past. Or, if you want a half hour of even deeper wisdom, also on my website, under the readings link, you can listen to me read Samuel Johnson's fine long poem, The Vanity of Human Wishes, one of the great world masterpieces of pessimism. My reading clocks in at 29 minutes, 33 seconds. So that's half an hour with 27 seconds left over for unrestrained weeping. And if you want to hear the Latin original that inspired Johnson, a couple of pages later there is my reading of Juvenal's 10th satire, which includes all the dirty bits. Nitpicking emails about my pronunciation of Latin will be ignored. I say it the way my schoolmasters taught me. Third bulletin item. Speaking of my personal website, for precisely the same number of keystrokes, but without the bother of having to remember the spelling of my name, you can go there by keying in the URL dissidentwrite.com. I own that URL, and I have set it to automatically redirect to johndarbyshire.com until I can figure out what to do with it. The URL dissidentwrite.org also works the same way. Okay, that may have been my longest intro ever. Let's get to the week's events. The first event of the week for me was the annual Conference of American Renaissance, held in the lovely Montgomery Bell State Park near Nashville, Tennessee, last weekend. I've been saying what I'm about to say every year for a while now, so I guess it's a cliche. Clichés are true, though, so I'll say it again. The AMREN conference gets younger and livelier every year. At the banquet on Saturday evening, I found myself sitting next to a 19-year-old attendee, listening to a 23-year-old speaker at the podium. AMREN is most definitely not a geezer show. You can read AMREN's own summary of the conference at their website. The transcript of my talk was published here on vdare.com, May 19th. I haven't yet seen conference videos posted online, but no doubt that's in the works. Check the AMREN site for notifications. I gave my talk at 10:30 Saturday morning. It ended on somewhat of a downbeat, so I was looking to Jared Taylor to cheer us up with his 2 p.m. address. Jared didn't disappoint. I'll admit that when the conference schedule had come out the week before, I had greeted the title of Jared's talk with a sad smile. The title was Why We Are Winning. Huh, I thought, in that sour, negative way of mine. Huh, that's like General Lee giving a talk on why we are winning while Sherman was marching to the sea. Anti-white, open borders, multiculturalists control Congress, the White House, the judiciary, the media, the corporations, the internet, the schools and the colleges. How exactly are we winning? In the event, Jared made a good solid case, resting it on the rising distrust among ordinary Americans of the media and the deep state, supported by awareness of the growing nationalist movements in Europe. I came away feeling much more hopeful. Catch the video of Jared's talk when they post it. He is really a very good, uplifting speaker. Thanks to the AMREN folk for organising this lively, instructive conference. Thanks also, of course, to the staff and management of the Inn at Montgomery Bell, who are invariably cheerful and polite, and to the law enforcement officers of the state of Tennessee, who kept the small squad of crazy anarchist protesters well corralled. And, of course, thanks to the attendees, who included a surprising number of Radio Derb fans, with kind words and even some gifts for yours truly. Thank you. Thank you. I hope everyone got home safely. Onward and upward with American Renaissance. In his Amren speech on Saturday, Jared Taylor described our president as a damp squib. And he said that we, the dissident right, have little to hope for from this presidency. It's hard to argue with that. The surprise of Trump is how ineffectual he's proving. I had supposed he might get some things wrong, commit some big clumsy blunders, but I never thought he'd just be spineless and ineffectual. That's what he's been, though. Typical example from this week. This was a tweet dated May 21st, quote, "I am very disappointed that Mexico is doing virtually nothing to stop illegal immigrants from coming to our southern border, where everyone knows that because of the Democrats, our immigration laws are totally flawed and broken. Mexico's attitude is that people from other countries, including Mexico, should have the right to flow into the US, and that US taxpayers should be responsible for the tremendous costs associated with this illegal immigration. Mexico is wrong, and I will soon be giving a response." End tweet. I'm sorry, Trumpists, but that's just pathetic in so many ways. "I am very disappointed." That's schoolmarm talk. "I'm very disappointed in you, Johnny. You can do much better. What will your mommy say?" Wagging a finger in little Johnny's face like that is appropriate when you are the schoolmarm and Johnny is a misbehaving 8-year-old. When you are the world's greatest economic and military power, and Johnny is a middling nation with 1/3 of your population and 1/8 your GDP, it sounds feeble and silly. If a lesser nation vexes a greater nation, there are things the greater nation can do on a wide spectrum. From taxing remittances or imposing tariffs at one end, to declaring war at the other end. And has little Johnny actually done anything wrong here? Why should Mexico expend effort and money stopping illegals coming to our border when we're such fools as to let them in? Which, of course, we are. Mexico has problems of its own. They're supposed to deal with our problems as well. And then there's that blustering, "I will soon be giving a response." It sounds like poor, impotent old King Lear. "I will do such things, what they are, yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth." The protection of our borders is not up to Mexico, Mr. President. It's not their business. It's our business, and we should attend to it. Nor is it entirely a matter of congressional inaction, deplorable as that is. There are plenty of things that you, as chief executive, could do yourself. Ryan Gierduski responded to that very same tweet of yours with a helpful list of those things. Will you do any of those things? Or will you just tweet and bluster? Those are rhetorical questions. I know the answers. So do the Mexicans. One side consequence of rising nationalism in Europe occurred today, Friday. This was the announcement by Theresa May, Britain's Prime Minister, that she will step down as leader of her party, the Conservative Party, on June 7th. There will then be a lame duck interlude of a few weeks while the party elects a new Prime Minister. I couldn't help thinking of the old English country saying, "Cast not a clout till May is out." The word clout there means a cloth, an item of clothing. The saying means, don't shed your winter clothing until the end of May. That's the common understanding anyway. Some people insist that May there actually refers to the May flower, so that the saying really means, don't shed your winter clothing until the Mayflowers are blooming, which I think happens in early May. Potato, potato. May is out, or soon will be. It's hard to believe that history will look kindly on Mrs. May's prime ministership. She came in 3 years ago following David Cameron's resignation. Cameron resigned because the Brexit referendum vote went against him. He was a Remainer. He didn't want Britain to leave the European Union. Curiously, Mrs. May was also a Remainer. Well nigh the whole British establishment were. It would have made sense, following the referendum, it would have made sense to pick a Leaver as Prime Minister. But they were too thin on the ground in governing circles. That Brexit vote of June 2016 was a real populist upsurge by ordinary people against the establishment, the metropolitan elites and the special interests. So, for 3 years against her own inclinations, Mrs. May struggled to work out a deal with the EU. A deal that split all the differences between Leavers and Remainers. It couldn't be done, of course. The differences are too fundamental. You either have a sovereign nation making its own laws and treaties in its own legislature, or you are one province in a supranational state, with key decisions made for you by foreigners. It's a difference that can't be split. Watching Mrs. May flailing around this past 3 years, trying to square all the circles, got to be embarrassing. I've actually been feeling sorry for her. Well, when I wasn't laughing at Tracy Ullman's impersonations of her. What the Brexit vote called for was a tough, fearless, ruthless leader, one with a set of cast-iron gonads. A Margaret Thatcher, in other words. Unfortunately, leaders like that don't come along very often. That's not Mrs. May's fault, and I'm sure she did her best. It hasn't helped Mrs. May that the polls leading up to elections for the European Parliament have shown her party, the Conservative Party, polling dismally among British voters, with Nigel Farage's Brexit Party doing far better. The Brits actually voted on Thursday, but other countries in Europe vote Friday, Saturday or Sunday. And the counts for earlier votes, like Britain's, are kept secret until Monday, so that later votes won't be influenced. So we won't know how Brits actually voted until next week. But it looks bad for the Conservatives. Britain aside, how well will nationalist parties do in these Euro elections? I wouldn't be looking for any miracles. Yes, there are some good, strong nationalist leaders in Europe today, pushing back against mass immigration and multiculturalism. Overall, though, there remains that problem of the ceiling that I've mentioned before. The limit of 20 to 25% of the vote that it seems hard for nationalist parties to break through. Here are the top 10 votes for a nationalist party in European national elections. Not the European Parliament elections we're just having. These are the latest national elections in each country. Number 1, Hungary. 49% for Fidesz. Number 2, Switzerland. 29% for the Swiss People's Party. Number 3, Austria. 26% for the Freedom Party. Number 4, Denmark. 21% for the Danish People's Party. Number 5, Estonia. 18% for the Conservative People's Party. Number 6, Finland. 18% for the Finns. Number 7, Sweden. 18% for Sweden Democrats. Number 8, Italy. 17% for the League. Number 9, Holland. 13% for the Freedom Party. Number 10, France. 13% for National Rally. That's not the whole story. In some countries, the nationalist vote is split with other parties. In Hungary, for example, with Jobbik. There are some subtractions to make too, since some of those national elections took place. Austria's Freedom Party, for example, got mixed up in an ugly scandal and seems to be holed below the waterline. There are some big historical differences of opinion too. For example, of attitudes to Russia, which are much more negative in Eastern Europe, for reasons not hard to figure. And, Britain aside, nobody much wants out of the EU. It was a Franco-German racket from the beginning. Those guys won't be leaving. The poorer, weaker nations of the EU have all been thoroughly bought. So, as I said, don't be looking for miracles when the Europarliament vote counts are published next week. The best to hope for is that as nationalist sentiment edges up towards that 20-25% ceiling, the big old centre parties will make moves to co-opt it. Centre there doesn't just mean centre-right either. As our own James Fulford noted the other day, Denmark's centre-left party, the Social Democrats, are now taking a strong line against mass immigration from the Middle East and Africa. Milton Friedman famously observed to Peter Brimelow back in 1997 that you can't have free immigration and a welfare state. The centre-left parties of Europe, who were the founders and guardians of their nation's welfare states, may be waking up to that simple fact. The third Duke of Norfolk an English aristocrat and a big political player back in the 16th century, was one of history's great reactionaries. He looked with scorn on what he called the new learning, which he understood to mean the notion that laymen like himself should be well educated. Education, in the Duke's mind, was for priests. His most famous remark, dear to the hearts of reactionaries everywhere, was in response to a colleague who chided him for not knowing the Bible very well. Sniffed the Duke, quote, "I never read the scripture and never will read it. It was merry in England before the new learning came up. Yea, I would all things were as hath been in times past." End quote. That is the true reactionary ideal. Perfect stasis, nothing ever changing. All things as hath been in times past. It's not exactly my ideal, I hasten to say, although I sometimes boast of reactionary tendencies. I'm all for some progress in scientific understanding, like the progress in pharmacology that is currently sparing me the horrors of old-style chemotherapy, not to mention an early death. Social progress, too. As a working-class lad, I'm very much obliged to the early 20th century social reformers whose efforts got me a free college education. The third Duke's aphorism keeps coming to mind, though, as I slowly work up through those old Radio Derb transcripts. I was reading and reformatting some from 2009 this week, from 10 years ago. It's hard not to notice that in key aspects of our national policy, stasis rules. The issues I was commenting on 10 years ago are the same ones I'm commenting on today. Example, one of many. Radio Derb for October 29th, 2009. Heading, Welfare for Illegals. My comment concerned a story in the Las Vegas Sun newspaper. The story told us that the anchor babies of illegal aliens had been poorly served by welfare agencies because their parents feared deportation. However, quote, "In the past few years there has been a push to better inform these parents by social service agencies and non-profits," end quote. Those poor anchor baby kiddies denied full welfare benefits just because their parents are scofflaws. Well, that was me a couple of days ago polishing up a Radio Derb transcript from 10 years earlier. Then, later that same evening, I watched some TV news. There on my TV screen was Ben Carson, our Secretary for Housing and Urban Development, up in front of the House Financial Services Committee. The chair critter of the committee, Maxine Waters of California, waxed indignant about Carson's, quote, "recent cruel proposal to terminate housing benefits for families that include individuals with mixed immigration statuses," end quote. Let me translate that for you. The topic here is illegal aliens living in public housing. You may think that's a thing that shouldn't happen, that public housing should be for Americans. But thinking that just betrays you as a hate-filled, racist, bigot filled with hateful hate. In fact, it's been happening for decades. The poster gal here, as Michelle Malkin reminded us the other day, the poster gal was Barack Obama's appalling Aunt Zaituni, who, much aided, of course, by the fact that she was Obama's aunt, gamed the welfare and immigration system's Nine Ways to Sunday, before going off to join the Choir Invisible in 2014, leaving dead and flattened in the roadway the quaint old idea that we are a nation of laws, not of men and their aunts. Well, going back to Chair Weasel Maxine Waters, what she meant by the phrase individuals with mixed immigration statuses in public housing was illegal aliens together with their anchor babies. The babies are, of course, US citizens by virtue of our current clinically insane jurisprudence on the 14th Amendment. So the issue before the Financial Services Committee the other day was the same one that I was kicking at 10 years ago. Welfare for illegal aliens via their anchor babies. The only difference I can perceive between now and then is that Congress Ninny Waters and her Democratic colleagues like Carolyn Maloney are more brazen, more shameless now in their mockery of our laws and our citizenship than they would have dared to be 10 years ago. That aside, the third Duke of Norfolk would have loved this spectacle. All things today are as hath been in times past. It's the same with other aspects of our national policy. How long has Radio Derb been asking out loud what the heck we are doing in Afghanistan? Well, it's been 11 years at least. We're still there, and I'm still asking. Everywhere you look at our nation's politics, the overwhelming impression is one of stasis. We're stuck in a rut, several ruts. All things are as hath been in times past. That's gladdening to the hearts of reactionaries like Maxine Waters and Carolyn Maloney, no doubt. But the rest of us would like to see a little forward movement. Just a little. Please. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. More feeble equivocation from our damp squib president. In a Fox News Channel interview with Steve Hilton aired last Sunday, Trump backed away from compulsory E-Verify as a way to stop the employment of illegal aliens. They were talking about the forthcoming Kushner plan on immigration reform.
And one thing that people have speculated about was that it might include E-Verify. Is that going to be in the...
So E-Verify is going to be possibly a part of it. The one problem is E-Verify is so tough that in some cases, like farmers, they're not equipped for E-Verify. I mean, I say this against Republicans. A lot of the Republicans say you go through an E-Verify. I used it when I built the hotel down the road on Pennsylvania Avenue. I use a very strong E-Verify system. And we would go through 28 people, 29, 30 people before we found one that qualified.
Right.
So it's a very tough thing to ask a farmer to go through that. So in a certain way, I speak against myself, but you also have to have a world of some practicality.
So forget about E-Verify, the one really potent weapon in our arsenal to stop illegal aliens, including the 60% of illegals who have flown in and overstayed visas, to stop them from taking American jobs. It's too tough. Item. Just listening to myself talking about Mrs. May back there, I may have been too kind to her and her party. Britain's Conservative Party hasn't done anything conservative for decades. David Cameron's proudest achievement, the one to which he devoted most political capital, was pushing homosexual marriage through Parliament in 2013. Mrs. May has been just as bad on cultural issues, if not worse. She has not lifted a finger against the banning and deplatforming of dissident voices. Indeed, as the boss reminds me, she banned Jared Taylor from entering Britain, or at least did nothing to stop her underlings banning him. So, yes, I was too charitable. You see, that's the problem with us older, chivalrous types when faced with a female politician. We're too nice. Item. In last week's Radio Derb, I ventured some mild remarks about creationism, for the first time in many years. Well, what do you know? Creationists are still around. I got a small email bag on that segment. I shall deal with it, patiently and politely, of course, in my monthly diary. Here, I just want to note a response from the Discovery Institute. That's the creationist think tank over in Seattle. Still in business, apparently. This response was from David Klinghoffer, whom I remember very dimly from across the editorial table at National Review. The gist of it is that I am a hatefully hateful person full of hate, and that this is the fault of Charles Darwin, in some way that I can't be bothered to figure out. Whatever. What came to my mind when reading David's remarks was one of those witty exchanges we used to get in Britain's Parliament before it filled up with bores and hacks. The exchange took place in 1978 between Dennis Healey, a scrappy, sharp-witted bloke serving as Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is to say Treasury Secretary, and Geoffrey Howe, an exceptionally courteous and mild-mannered fellow serving as Shadow Chancellor. The milquetoast Mr. Howe had offered some long, murmured critique of Healey's economic policy. In rebuttal, Healey told the House that being criticised by Howe was, quote, like being savaged by a dead sheep. That's it, ladies and gents. And once again, there will be no Radio Derb next week. We'll be back on the air June 7th. God willing and the creek don't rise. This year is, as I've noted elsewhere, unusually rich in anniversaries. You can almost pick a day at random and it'll commemorate something. Today, for example, May 24th, is the 200th birthday of Queen Victoria. For the full nostalgia rush, you need something more recent, of course. Here's one that gives me the rush. May 25th, 1969. That was the United States release date for the movie Midnight Cowboy. In London, where I was actually living that year, the movie came out on September 25th, just 3 weeks after Easy Rider. It was a standard point of discussion among us 20-somethings at the time as to which of those two movies was cooler. The avant-garde crowd favoured Easy Rider. Those of us of a more conservative temperament preferred Midnight Cowboy. I re-watched Easy Rider in 2015 and poured scorn on it in Taki's magazine. Sample quote, I'd forgotten how obnoxiously daft the 1960s counterculture was. Watching Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper act out their rebellion against bourgeois conformity, I wanted to put on a suit and tie, light up a Chesterfield and mix myself a martini. End quote. I can't recall having re-watched Midnight Cowboy, but it still glows in memory after 50 years. I have no doubt it was way the better of those two movies. Archer Winston, the New York Post movie critic at the time, called Midnight Cowboy, quote, an epic of the underside, a masterpiece of small lives and meagre ambitions, end quote. I think that's exactly right. I had never been to New York City at that point, so the New York of John Voight and Dustin Hoffman became New York for me, and I'm sure for millions of other provincial youngsters around the world. When I actually arrived in the city 4 years later, and quickly fell into destitution, just like Joe and Ratso had, the mental map supplied by Midnight Cowboy helped me survive, I am sure. Ah, memories, memories. Today's New York Post has a two-page commemorative piece about Midnight Cowboy by the newspaper's arts editor, Barbara Hoffman, who may or may not be related to Dustin Hoffman, I don't know. It has lots of interesting factlets that I didn't know. I didn't know, for example, that Bob Dylan wrote Lay Lady Lay for Midnight Cowboy, but was late delivering it and they'd locked in the movie soundtrack already. Sorry, I'm rambling. Sometimes the past just takes over. Radio Derb will be back, refreshed and facing the future, 2 weeks from now. Here to sing us out is, of course, Harry Nilsson.
Everybody's talking at me, I don't hear words they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still, I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain, going well, the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone.